at the event link on KPFT's Facebook page. Students pay $25 with a valid student ID at the door. If you're concerned about the direction the country's going, come join me, Grant, and a bunch of like-minded people on August 9th to discuss and maybe work some things out. See you there. Tag, you're it.
Hi, I'm Mel.
And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
It's a little scary on Earth tonight. In all the darkness, it's kind of hard to see the light. We need more people with compassionate and fewer commandos. Stand up for what's right on Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. It's time to live. It's time to grow. Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. No more animal rodeos. Standing up for animals is a different kind of fight. When corporations keep the truth far from our sight, but the ones who see the truth can't ever let it go. The truth is alive on Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. It's time to live. It's time to grow. Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. An animal-free Fandango. Climate chaos. A dog and planetary plight. Temperatures reaching annual record heights. If the world ends tomorrow, I'll see you in the afterglow. The postmortem's live on Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. It's time to live. It's time to grow. Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. The One Health message in stereo. Leaves right now. You've got a ticket for this flight. Did you think we'd let you leave alone? The stars are burning bright. Strap in tight. Ready for takeoff. Ignition, here we go. It's Monday night and time for your Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. It's time to live. It's time to grow. Vegan World Radio. Vegan World Radio. Let love be your dynamo.
All right, it's Monday night. That means it's Vegan World Radio. I'm going to let love be my dynamo here at KPFT 90.1 in Houston on the FM dial and streaming at kpft.org. We'll be here for an hour. My name is Skyjack Morgan. Over there is Dr. Crystal Heath, the veterinarian. We're going to be your host today. How you doing, Crystal?
I'm good. I'm actually not in Houston right now. I'm in Washington, D.C. at the American Veterinary Medical Association convention that is happening right now. And
what,
I hope
what
we
is
can talk.
That?
That is the most important. Well, no, not the way, not the most important.
It's an important.
It's an important convention. This is where the House of Delegates votes on various new resolutions. And there's lots of continuing education, and all of the pharmaceutical companies and different organizations get together to advertise their stuff to us. And I've had a lot of interesting conversations, so I hope to tell you about the talks that I've attended.
Yeah,
things
I want to get
to those.
I've talked
to people about, but first, I want to talk about something that's happening on Wednesday.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah, because that's like national. Okay, so let's talk about the. All right, I have some questions about the AVMA stuff. So I'll put those on my.
Yeah,
I'll put those on ice.
Hold.
I'll put those on ice. What's this other thing that's working its way through our national politics right now involving animals?
Another big important Washington, D.C. thing is the House Committee on Agriculture is having a hearing about Prop 12.
Again, now, this Prop 12.
Again,
thing,
this keeps coming up.
Why do they want it? Why do they hate Prop 12 so much? Why do they hate states' rights so much over in Washington, D.C.? Can you tell me? Can you refresh my memory? I feel like I've heard it a million times, but every time you tell me, I feel like it's the first time, Crystal.
Those crazies over there in California
Yeah.
voted 63% to pass a law stating that they do not want some of the raw meat sold in their state that comes from pigs whose mothers were confined to crates that they deemed too small. So this means most pigs, no, most mother pigs in the United States are housed in these 2.5 foot by 7.5 foot put gestation
gestation
stalls
crates, right?
For 114 days of their pregnancy. This leads to elevated risk of infectious diseases like Campylobacter, like Salmonella. That also came up at the AVNA convention in different contexts, just how many people get Campylobacter infections every year.
It's a killer,
it's a
right?
lot. Yeah. It can kill people, but it mostly we waste a lot of money hospitalizing these people who are sick with Campylobacter. Of course, it doesn't matter that people get sick. We don't care about ethics and people's welfare here. We care about our workforce. And this means that people aren't showing up for work.
They ain't showing up for work. How am I going to make $1 billion if my people aren't going to show up, my human resources?
Yeah. And they aren't going to the store and buying stuff when they're sick with Campylobacter.
Well, they must be buying medicine, Crystal. They're buying something. They're going to, I'm sure that CVS loves this Campylobacter.
Well, yeah, and if they don't have health insurance, then the taxpayers have to pay for it. But anyway, before we go too off course, Wednesday, July 23rd at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, the U.S. House Committee on Agriculture will hold a hearing titled An Examination of the Implications of Proposition 12. And so we're thinking there might be this potential skinny farm bill later this fall. And this week's hearing on California's Proposition 12 is directly relevant to the work that's potentially aiming to defeat the language in the skinny farm bill that would overturn Prop 12. So
The skinny farm bill thing kind of blows my mind. I don't know if you know, because like every 5 years we're supposed to have a farm bill, and it seems like we're not able to. It seems like we might not actually get a farm bill, but we have to. It's in the law, right? We have to have a farm bill. What's with the skinny farm bill? What's with this? Like, what are we doing here?
We already passed with the one big beautiful bill a lot of the really economically important things that all of the commodity farmers, the crop farmers needed. So now there's sort of like just less of a desire. Like the big players got their interests taken care of. And now I think with this new skinny farm bill, they're really going to slim down language. And before it was like the language, the EATS Act, which was meant to overturn bills like Proposition 12, the language was so broad that it had like all of these implications that affected all states' rights. Now they're really trying to pare down the language so it just affects Prop 12. And they're like, just pass this. We just overturned Prop 12 and like, that's it. We're not impinging on other states' rights in any way. Just Prop 12.
And not just Prop 12, right? It's going to affect all states still, because it'll affect animal rights activists, animal welfare activists, people who care about animals. Because even though this seems so small, because you like you said, it's a little bit laughable, right? It's raw meat from pigs whose mothers were held in tiny cages.
Yeah.
And it's a very small percentage of the animal flesh.
Even though more than 60% of mother pigs are housed in these gestation stalls, but it's only raw whole meat, unprocessed. It's not ground meat. It's a very specific, you know, type of.
I like to say
pork.
Like you could still buy a Slim Jim at the 7-Eleven if the flesh inside came from an animal whose mother was in a gestation crate. You just couldn't buy a pork chop from a pig whose mother was in a gestation crate. It seems so modest, but I think it goes to show that even these modest proposals, if you're a Jonathan Swift fan, you'll know that these modest proposals really get people very upset, and it gets these corporations very upset because they think it's a slippery slope, right? They're going to, so this new EATS Act or skinny farm bill, whatever we're calling it now, it really is about stifling the will of the people, as far as I'm concerned, right? People voted for it. And now it just goes to show, like, even if you do things, quote unquote, the right way, and this is something we talk about with activism all the time, like, what's the right way? And we all have fights about it. We disagree. But even here, they did it the right way. Put it on the ballot. We'll vote for it. They did it. It passed. They still don't. They still are fighting it in the most underhanded and devious ways.
Yeah, and that just speaks to, like, if we are going to pass other animal welfare legislation, other animal protection bills, they're just going to do the same thing again, where they're going to try to fight it. And they're going to waste their resources, which they have many more resources than we do. We spent so much of our resources fighting this, and we're like, yeah, we're draining dry, but they're also, you know, using a lot of our resources too. So.
And our tax money is their resource. This is what's so galling. It's like we're using our resources to fight the people that we are funding against our will. So what's a vegan to do? Here we are in Vegan World Radio. What am I supposed to do about all
but
this?
But here's the thing. So in theory, it's not there's the National Pork Producers Council, which is not necessarily taxpayer funded. The National Pork Board is is under the USDA Agriculture Marketing Service, so is supported by our tax dollars in sort of a vague way. They get money. A certain few cents of every pig sold goes to the National Pork Board, but it's under the umbrella of the USDA. So the USDA, our tax dollars, support that apparatus. And the National Pork Board, it cannot lobby for legislation. So they, in theory, had nothing to do with Prop 12 and fighting Prop 12. So I just want to be very clear, because, you know, it's not exactly like our tax dollars are fighting against us, though you could make the argument that, you know, these industries are subsidized very heavily through crop insurance and other programs like that.
That was the argument that I was trying to make. Yes. I wasn't being as explicit about it. Yes.
Clarifying for the listeners.
I get what you mean. Yeah, yeah. To be very
precise. I get very pedantic about these things.
I appreciate your pedantry, doctor. But I do want to hold firm that we are funding these corporations that are making billions of dollars off of our humanity and off of the people dying from these curable diseases that are caused by all this flesh eating, and then also they're making money off of all these animals that are being, if you take the gestation crate alone, they're being tortured. Like, the gestation crate is a torture device. I don't know how people can see it. You look at a photo of it and it's pretty clear. I've never seen a person go, oh, I think this looks fine. I've never heard someone do that, right?
I have.
You have?
As a veterinarian?
Yeah, I'm sure you have.
I have had discussions with fellow veterinarians who say those pigs are quite happy. And in fact, I say things like, you know, they're lacking enrichment, environmental enrichment, and they're displaying signs of stereotypic behavior. And they push back and say, well, my office lacks enrichment too, and things like that. And, you know, they're being fed, they're happy, and they're much happier than they would be if they were in a group pen fighting with their pen mates.
These are the types of people that go, like, when I was in, I forget what state I was in, but I was driving across America and I pull over and there's this buffalo in a cage at a small pen, but an American bison, you know, at a gas station. And it's like, come see our bison. You look at this sad animal. I have to laugh because it's, or else I'll cry. Because you look at this poor beast and he's just alone, and that's his whole life. At the side, on the side of the road, and he's just by the gas pumps, and people look at him as they fill up their gas. Like, it's just,
this bison's like in a cage in the gas station.
He's like in a small corral, like, because you can't make it too big because the people want to stop and they want to look, so it's a viewing pen. But this is where he lives.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. It's quite sad, and I just feel like that's the same kind of thing. Oh yeah, well. Why does it need enrichment? My office doesn't have enrichment. I don't even have a window in my office. I mean, this buffalo has it better than me.
We'll talk a little bit more about how maybe the confinement of animals has led to the loss of humans' rights. But first, the AVMA did vote on their resolution on sow housing. We've already talked about this previously, and I don't want to dive too far into it. But they passed a resolution, made some incremental changes, but didn't explicitly condemn gestation crates in their new resolution, which was concerning because they also supported historic EATS Act language in the Farm Bill, Section 12007, that would have overturned the Prop 12 and said that, you know, basically gestation crates were necessary for veterinarians to provide sows with the type of housing they need. And we shouldn't take away veterinarians' ability to choose what kind of housing they need in various situations. But anyway,
I'm starting to think the American Veterinary Medical Association is owned by the corporations that are running these massive exploitation rings. I don't know if I'm just starting to get that feeling. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that they are.
Given all the people who sponsor the AVMA convention and all their corporate sponsors, it would definitely seem that's the case. Their stakeholders seem to be mostly industry corporate interests. But there were some good things at the AVMA convention. Some of us with more progressive voices did have our voices heard. And I went to, and why does the AVMA convention matter? Because what happens at the AVMA convention is an indicator of the trajectory of animal policy in the United States and really the world, because the World Veterinary Association Global One Health Summit was held in conjunction, and I went to a lot of talks about that, which I'll go into.
So what do you wear at an event like this, Crystal? Are you all dressed up like in a little suit, or are you wearing an animal rights shirt that says "Stop eating animals, you bloody murderers"? Are you wearing something that's what are you doing?
No, I was dressed in my puffer jacket, scarf, multiple layers, because they had the air conditioning on to like 50 degrees and I was dying of cold. And everybody joked, it was like, you realize it's summer and outside it's like 90 degrees and humid.
Oh yeah, DC is hot in the summer,
But inside it was freezing, and even with my puffer jacket, I was freezing cold. But yeah, I just wore regular slacks, and I had like a nice top on, but covered up with outerwear.
Oh, I was hoping you were wearing animal rights messaging head to toe, but okay.
No, I don't think that would have played well, because in order to change somebody's mind, you have to first foster trust. They have to know that you care about them. And that's what I'm doing, is fostering trust, building relationships. And that's how you then are taken seriously. So that was my strategy I'm going with, because I do like these people. I know everybody got into veterinary medicine because they love animals. And along the way, this culture happened where they've been led to believe that they're doing difficult but necessary work.
And we all kind of get the empathy beaten out of us. I would, you know, with the caveat that, you know, the ALF, when with their balaclavas and everything, people take them seriously, just in a different way, I guess. But I get what
you
mean.
I don't think the right people take them seriously, as has been shown by the lack of animal protection policy and the erosion of our human and animal rights in this country over the past 30 years. So maybe we can have that argument a little bit later.
I just think that they're taken seriously. I think people can be taken seriously in various states of various costumes, let's just say.
Yeah, and I don't think they're taken seriously by people who matter.
Okay.
Come at me, bro.
I don't want to argue the virtues of the ALF, because I don't know, the feds are listening. So why don't you tell me what was going on there? Tell me about how that we helped animals at the AVMA.
The Animal Welfare and Veterinary Education Joint Seminar was held, and they discussed the welfare and ethics in animal use in veterinary education. And the one talk I went to was fantastic, and I actually talked to this person the next day, and he had a little hand in getting my recent paper published, I think, which I won't, I shouldn't say anything, but I'm thankful to him for his behind the scenes work to help push a paper that I was writing along, which will be published any day now, about the use of animals in veterinary schools. So that'll be huge. But he discussed anatomy labs and, like, are they really beneficial to students? They are super stressful. You have to learn 1,000 different body parts on animals that do not look like live animals. These are embalmed cadavers that stink. Their tissues are hard. There's no bleeding. And you work in teams of four dissecting these dead dogs that are sourced from questionable places. Veterinary students go in there naive, not even knowing to question how these animals are sourced and whether the objectives of this lab are even relevant. Like, does this, and he just asked the question of, like, does this actually contribute to veterinarians being able to be good veterinarians day one, or is this a giant waste of time? And he kind of argued that, like, rote memory of these 1,000 body parts on tissue that doesn't look like real animal tissue might not be very beneficial, and emphasize the need to, like, move away from
Crystal,
these.
We've always done it this way. What do you mean?
But
we've always done it this way. You mean we're not going to get old dead animals and young dead animals, and we're not going to get them and chop them up into little pieces and teach them?
And turns out that this model does not effectively prepare students for becoming competent clinicians.
Weird.
It does not develop critical thinking skills and may even hinder students' ability to use instruments and even make students think of animals themselves as instruments, which is harmful. He talked about the moral aspects of this too, and how it hinders our moral development. Really, really great stuff, and suggested the use of alternatives and more transparency and communication with students and the public regarding the use of animals in education. So really, really fantastic stuff. But there,
you said something that kind of stuck out to me, because it's something that's near and dear to my heart. You know, I try to talk about this on, and a lot of my work is the advocacy for more critical thinking, which is, I think, in essence, questioning the status quo, questioning authority, challenging those things. And I mean, do we really want critical thinkers? Is that what the profession wants? I mean, I do. I mean,
yeah.
But is that what veterinary schools want? They want critical thinkers, people that are going to challenge all this?
I think the big argument against critical thinking in veterinary school is it's going, if students, and I've read this in other books too. One is The Occasional Human Sacrifice by Carl Elliott. He talks about medical school and other things. And it's like, if you have a bunch of students questioning the curriculum all the time, that can be exhausting. And at some point you do need students just to do the thing and not be constant. You can't have a bunch of students doing a bunch of different things, but maybe actually you can. Maybe we actually should. So
maybe
I
some
think
standardization
that, or that's always been the pushback of, like, we have to keep these students in line or else it's going to go off the rails and everybody's going to be doing their own thing. And we can't have that. But
yeah, you can't just have it your way. What is this, Burger King?
Maybe we can. We are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for this education. So,
well, yeah. I mean, I guess that would be the thing, is to try to promote critical thinking and challenging the status quo. I guess, you know, I don't know. I studied the humanities. You know, I wasn't one of those lockstepers. I wasn't. I had a different career path, you know, and especially academically. And we were taught to challenge almost any idea. But also, when it came to, like, the bureaucracy and navigating all of that and all of the how to get published and how all that stuff, that's just how it is. You're just going to have to play that game if you really want to go. But then they were always trying to game the system too and be like, oh, you know what? Start this from the last paragraph. You know? Don't read the intro. Just read the last paragraph and then read up. And things like that with academic journals or whatnot. So, I mean, even there, we were trying. I guess you could have your cake and eat it too, is what I'm saying. You can have critical thinking in these things, and then in the other stuff, maintain that order that is desired, like you're saying. You know what I mean? Don't you want some order? Yeah.
I mean, and that's the thing. The next big discussions that were around One Health. And I think that's an area where it's like, yeah, we also need some critical thinking in how we address infectious disease outbreaks. And we also need some structure on how we do this. And one former USDA veterinarian did this talk on a One Health retrospective of SARS-CoV-2 and the origins. And this was really interesting because he admitted, like, it's kind of been like a thing among scientists that lab leak theory is bunk. And of course, it came from natural origins from bat populations, and there was a spillover event. We haven't quite figured out who the intermediary host is, but this lab leak theory is crazy. But now we're hearing more and more respected scientists saying, you know, the lab leak theory isn't crazy. And I think we as scientists have to start acknowledging uncertainty, or else we won't be taken seriously. And he went into that and how medical professionals lost public trust during the COVID-19 outbreak because we weren't transparent and we weren't acknowledging what we didn't know. So that was super interesting. And at the end, when he asked if there's any questions, my hand immediately went up. And I said, I can't help but notice that a lot of the similarities that led to the lack of public trust in our health professionals during COVID-19 crisis are happening again during this avian influenza outbreak. We're repeating the same patterns that led to this lack of public trust. Can you describe some of the mistakes we've made during the avian influenza outbreak and what you would have done differently? And he was like, yes, absolutely. Like, we have not been testing enough. We have not been communicating well enough and information sharing during this outbreak. Lack of information sharing between the CDC and the NIH. We need more testing programs. We need sustained funding for research and innovation. And that was really good. And then the next speaker like dovetailed off of me. He said, that's a really excellent question and point. So I felt good about, you know, hammering home that point.
How do you feel about his answer, though? Because, like, I don't know, a while back, probably now 10 years ago, I read a book called Unscientific America by Chris Mooney, and it was talking about how scientific literacy is evaporating in America. And he used examples about like Pluto not being a planet and how it really made people angry, or the Brontosaurus not being a real dinosaur. That was a fake dinosaur. And people get really upset about that, and they stop believing scientists because they're like, what, you didn't know Pluto wasn't a planet this whole time? And he brings it back to like how religion seems to be able to communicate these changes over time. Like, they have vast shifts in dogma. They have vast shifts in what they preach, and yet everyone seems to be able to go along with it. But scientists never seem to be able to communicate those things. I think it's, you know, they say, well, NIH and CDC should have communicated more. All right, well, that's great. How does that help, like, the layperson have any faith in scientists?
Loved for him to say how the industry influenced this outbreak, because the big thing was, like, we were told, don't worry, it's not being transmitted in the milk. It's not going to the milk supply. Then we find out 20% of milk is infected with H5N1. Don't worry, pasteurization kills the virus. Then there were studies saying pasteurization may not kill the virus.
Right, that they were fine nucleic acid
and
of the virus.
And I'm not saying, before you come after me, I'm not saying drinking pasteurized milk is not safe, but yeah.
No, they seem to dismiss those things out of hand because it behooves the corporations to do so they can maintain the status quo. And I understand that desire, but they're also really good at communicating that stuff. They get it out there at the
corporations know how to market. They know how to say things. They know how to persuade. Scientists do not know how to do that. We're not taught that.
Corporations hire communicators to do that, and I feel like scientists never even they have bought that line that STEM is the only thing that matters. Humanities is BS. We don't need these humanities majors with all their wishy-washy poetic BS and jargon. We want CDC and NIH need to be PRQs and TSTs and get their TPS reports in order. I mean, it's just like, no, like what you were saying, I read your notes and I'm like, man, it just seems like this is more of the same. From it's just scientific navel gazing. Like, I get, I understand, and I even agree that there were so many mistakes in COVID, and it did erode the public trust in scientists and in science. Like, it's crazy. People don't even believe in science, you know, don't even acknowledge the scientific method anymore. They couldn't even tell you what it is.
And I think well, because we seem like, don't worry, trust us. We're experts. We went to school for a long time.
Yeah.
And I see on the veterinary message boards all the time when a client questions what a veterinarian says or their advice, a lot of veterinarians think it's clever to like comment back, did you go to vet school? Or like their breeder says something and they comment back to the breeder, like, did your breeder go to vet school?
Right.
Like that is some, just because you went to vet school, you know more. No, you cannot make that argument.
Where did you go to college?
Absolutely. That is so toxic and so harmful, and we need to do better. So, you know, I'm just glad that we're opening the doors and we need to train more science communicators. I'm going to work on myself and how I can be a better communicator of science and, you know, maybe start inspiring more people to be good veterinary communicators, because, you know, the ag industry is training their people on how to be good persuasive communicators. That I heard that a lot too. It's like, we need some of those elite farmers to start setting an example and communicating to their other farmer friends how they should be doing this.
Yeah,
I think we need to develop those skills too.
You know, it's really funny because when I was in college and I was kind of a famous poet, and I fancied myself, and I did my first big trip to New York where I was doing readings and meeting these other famous poets who I never met before, who were also getting published, and we all thought we were really hot, you know, in that little world. And when I went to New York, I was like, how are you guys all afford? Now, I was living in the San Francisco Bay, but in New York, I was like, how are you guys affording to live here? This is insane. And almost all of them worked for either corporations like the ones we're talking about, or they were working, writing copy for those types of corporations, writing communiques and whatnot, or they were working for, what do you call it? Like the unscripted television. What do they call it? Reality TV. They were all working for reality TV and writing the, there are no scripts, right? But they have a story beats they have to meet and all the other stuff. They were all working in this stuff that we think that writers aren't needed, but they are. That's where they were making all their money. So I feel like if scientists did the same thing, maybe we would be better off. Maybe people would understand why Pluto is no longer a planet and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. But some other great things.
Yes.
This was the 11th World Veterinary Association Global One Health Summit. Lots of cool data on the impact of antimicrobial resistance, which could reduce our GDP by 2%. 70%, 75% of emerging infectious diseases in humans originate from animals. That over 800 million people worldwide.
800 million, yeah.
Chronic hunger, and more than 2 million lack regular access to safe and nutritious food. And the lovely, two lovely people spoke about veterinarians in the future of food security, aquaculture, insect protein, lab-grown meat. I got to see their rehearsal, and I didn't get to see, you know, their final talk and the audience reaction to that because I was busy tabling for the National Association of Federal Veterinarians. But I did come back for their final discussion, and it seemed like they got a lot of positive reaction. One person said that they were very happy that one of the speakers was a venture capitalist, and he said that he wasn't here for anything except to make money. And that played really well, because it's like, it shows an honesty, a lack of hypocrisy, and which is why I think economic arguments really work better than ethics or wealth or arguments. But that's just me. Especially, it plays well with veterinarians who are all about the economic arguments.
I'm sure that Andrew Tate would agree. I mean, this is where I think, like, oh yeah, we got to make that paper. Yeah, it's all about, I'm here to make money, I'm not here to make friends and all this. Like, to
know your audience, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so, man. But it's like, that's exactly what I'm annoyed with this whole, with so many things. It's like, we can say in the same, like you did, and I'm not faulting you at all, but like, you know, we're saying 800 million people worldwide are not going to eat. They're going hungry.
Yeah.
They're facing starvation, not because of a lack of abundance. We are living in abundant times. We could feed far more people on planet Earth than exist today. We have a distribution problem, and that distribution problem is at the hands of these people who are into profit over people. This is, I'm here to make money. I'm not here to feed people. Like, this is exactly the problem. And how do we change those people? Like, I want to feed those 800 people because they're part of the grand human experience. And I know that might sound naive to people, but maybe we need a little bit more hope and love in this world and less of this jaundiced eye of pure profit motive, you know? Dang it.
Well, maybe, but how do we get in there? One person said, you know, because I was a little muse, and during the rehearsal, I said, you know, veterinarians have been granting public trust in modern intensive animal-based protein, and we now need to be the ones to foster public trust in animal-free methods of protein production. They're like, oh, we're going to use that. That sounds really good. But somebody did say, you know, you can't just come in here and expect us to trust you. But I, you know, I would have, they did a really good job at shooting down that comment, but I would have said, you know, Cargill's been around a long time and I don't trust them, you know?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I also say like, okay, well, don't trust me. In fact, when I do my YouTube show, I'm always going like, hey, don't trust me. Don't take my word for it. Google this stuff. Do your own research. Google everything that everybody says. Everything that everybody says, you should double check. That's critical thinking as well, by the way, is to check your sources. Like, okay, that sounded good. Wait a second. Like Noam Chomsky always says, with the higher degree of confidence that someone tells you something, it should be the higher degree of skepticism, because that confidence that someone tells you something with forces you to like, oh yeah, this guy's telling the truth. But that's like it's a trick of evolution, right? You're being tricked by your own guts. Really, you should be going, this guy has a lot of confidence. I should double check this guy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and what you're saying is totally, how do we convince these people? Well, I don't think that this 2% reduction in worldwide, what is it, GDP, 2% GDP because of antimicrobial resistance, which is basically, you know, superbugs, is going to cost us 2% GDP. And that 75% of emerging infectious diseases in humans originate in animals. Clearly, no one seems to care. So it's like, I don't know.
Yeah, that's not the nail in the coffin, but it's all about momentum. And everybody wants to jump on the bandwagon. And if we show, hey, this is the way the wind is blowing, get on board. I think that might be the thing. I think the enthusiasm in the room of veterinarians being like, oh, this is where we're going, this is where we're heading, this is where we're going to protect our public health and our food security these innovations.
Yeah, every time I point out that Tyson is one of the largest investors in animal-free food, people like, what? Yeah, because they know stuff we don't. They got numbers we don't have, we're not privy to. They understand that the writing's on the wall and we can't be doing this forever. I think that's why... Mm-hmm. I think that's the obvious reason why they're investing so much in animal-free agriculture and animal-free protein. But I want to also just take for a second, ask everybody, if you're really cool and you like what we're doing, this is Vegan World Radio. We talk about animal-related issues and politics and current events. I'm talking with a veterinarian here, someone, an expert in the field, and this is at kpft.org, and it's 90.1 on the FM dial in Houston. If you want, you can go to kpft.org. Donate a little money. I think if you donate $100, they'll send you a really bomb t-shirt that says Vegan World Radio on it. And it's my favorite t-shirt that I have in my collection. And I think you might enjoy it too. So consider going on there. You know that public radio, I am a huge supporter and consumer of listener-supported radio. And I'm terrified about what's going on with the Big Beautiful Bill and the rescission package that just happened, about something like almost $2 billion have been erased from public news and public services like the ones we're providing right here on KPFT. So please consider making a donation and keeping the dream alive.
Yeah, absolutely. I will just mention one bad thing or a couple of bad things about the AVMA convention, just because I want to get to the things that you're talking about, not hog the airwaves. But one person did give a talk on the role of the veterinarian in animal welfare. Mm. And I didn't get to attend their talk because there's another talk I wanted to go to. But their handout, and somebody did tell me about this talk afterwards, and we discussed it there. And I looked at their handout, which says animal rights implies that animals have rights that are immutable and cannot be infringed upon by the needs of humans, where animal welfare acknowledges the human and sometimes consumptive use of animals and seeks mm-hmm. to balance that use with the needs and treatment of animals. And I spoke to some people. This person was a diplomat of the American College of Animal Welfare, which I am close with the American College of Animal Welfare, talked to a lot of folks there. And a lot of the people were like, yeah, that's just the old guard thinking. That's not what we believe, really, which is nice.
Yeah.
But and maybe what we can go on to this whole discussion maybe a little bit later or maybe, you know, some other time. But spoiler alert, animals already do have rights under the law. And in some ways, there are some animals who have more rights right now than some humans. So this argument that like we have to not be supportive of animal rights just flies in the face of the fact that animals already do have rights.
Yeah, I mean, it's like saying not supporting human rights. Humans already have rights. You just have to stop abridging them. It's not exactly that women didn't have rights in America. It's that their legal rights weren't acknowledged and they didn't have them on the books and they were being abridged. Their moral rights were being abridged. Women always had rights. Men just took them away. Just kept stomping
that
on the earth.
But there's also like the Endangered Species Act. You can't kill an animal. You can't destroy animals that are protected under the Endangered Species Act. And they can steal your crops. They can cross borders freely, whereas humans can't do that.
That's something I talk about almost every day, Crystal. Yeah. Why do I need a passport and the birds don't? I can fly with an airplane. Why do I need to ask the government, Mommy, may I please leave the country, sir? Please, like I'm a sniveling. What happened? I'm just a sniveling animal. I'm not even a human. You know, it's like I have no rights because I've got to ask someone permission to leave. I've got to ask someone permission where I can go. I feel that very. I feel that very vividly.
And, yeah, exactly.
And it bothers me tremendously, especially as the whims of government seem to be changing all around us. Right? There's what's that line in Dune, the opening line of Dune, like there's treachery beneath the shifting sands or something like that. And he's talking.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the original Dune was written about the Red Scare. And I think I kind of want to read it again, even though the movies don't really tell you that you don't really get that from the movies. The metaphor was about the Red Scare. And I kind of want to reread them because I feel like we are in the modern McCarthyism all over again. But
yeah,
I mean,
I will finish with this final thing that the most controversial thing talked about, the most thing that caused the greatest uproar among veterinarians was this talk, how veterinarians can improve animal welfare in commercial dog breeding kennels. And there's an article that came out after this talk that says, "Adopt, don't shop" is a popular slogan, but may not apply to everyone. Breeders help fill this gap and are a critical part of the supply of future generations of dogs.
Wow.
And
how'd that make you feel?
I was just like, wow, that's just like saying ban fur is a popular slogan, but may not apply to everyone who wants to slaughter animals to wear fur. Like, what does that even mean?
I don't know what that means. That was a stretch, wasn't it? Like, wow, yeah. Yeah, it might not apply to everyone who wants a dog, so adopt, don't shop, forget about it.
Yeah,
it's these we slogans.
We have so much evidence to show that puppies raised in commercial breeding establishments have high rates of serious behavior concerns, and the only role of veterinarians in this conversation should be to shut these places down. So it's really surprising that not only would they have this talk there, but that the AVMA would then write a news article highlighting this talk over all of the other wonderful talks that were had.
I wonder what would be their motivation for something like that.
You know, I sat across my table that I was tabling at, sat right across from the AKC, and I didn't talk to them. But yeah,
the American Kennel Club's an interesting organization. I have a lot of, you know, my mother was a breeder, and I have lots of problems with the AKC, and she ended up having lots of problems with it too when she kind of woke up, and it was, it's such a difficult thing. People want to have dogs, you know, and or do they, or have they been tricked into wanting to have dogs?
It's all marketing. Is it? Of course. It's not an innate consumer demand to have a defective dog with a smushed face who can't breathe and can only give birth via C-sections. That's marketed to people. Most people care about animals and want to protect them. So this whole AKC thing is BS, and it's a multi-million-dollar a year organization. Their CEO makes over $1 million a year. It's a nonprofit. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, I would go even further and say, hey, maybe the whole having dogs thing is a marketing thing too. There's a reason why dogs are in TV and movies, and every more than 50% of American households have dogs all of a sudden, and it's not a human thing. Most cultures don't.
I don't know.
Most humans cultures from aren't that crazy.
Several thousand years ago, when dogs and humans evolved together, it wasn't because of marketing.
But then we would see people having dogs in their beds in every culture across the world. That would be a human thing, but it isn't. It's an American thing. Most cultures don't. Most cultures don't have dogs in people's houses. Even if you go down to Mexico, they're not that crazy about dogs. Not like us. Like
I don't know. When I went to Mexico, people love their dogs, and their dogs everywhere.
Their dogs everywhere in the streets.
It's and some are very well cared for, and there's a reason why there's dogs in the streets, and they're not like putting poison out and killing all the dogs because
they don't
want to
kill them. I'm not saying they hate them, Crystal. I'm just saying they don't all want to bring them into their houses and put them in baby cribs and strollers and backpacks, and like that's an American thing that every house has to have a dog living in it.
And
over
maybe a
50%.
Korean thing.
Let's
think that Koreans are adopting that lifestyle.
Are they adopting the fur baby lifestyle? I don't know. Yeah. I think it's marketing. I think it's a whole, it's a way for people to make money. And I think that's why they're, it's so bothering. And I know people think I'm an extremist every time this comes up, because they're like, what, you want everyone not to have dogs? What are you going to do with all the dogs? Man, I don't need to solve all the problems. I just think it's a little bit of a, I think your brain has been hacked. You're probably not supposed to have all these dogs.
Anyway, the AVMA closed with a fireworks celebratory closing ceremony.
That's pro animal, isn't it? Everyone loves fireworks. Yeah. Animals
love
fireworks.
Everyone loves fireworks. Classic AVMA. Yeah.
Animals love fireworks. Yes. See, you were the crazy vegan there, saying, "What's up with the fireworks?"
I didn't go to the closing ceremony because I don't do crowds. People, but I just saw in their Instagram posts that they're like, fireworks and ice cream made the closing ceremony of the Meghan Trainor concert. That
Well, I was thinking about how, you know, we talk about animals so much, and it's clearly our focus, but this is also Vegan World Radio, and I kind of wanted to ask you about vegans. We don't really talk about vegans very much, and veganism. They're the worst ones. And every time veganism comes up, like in online or where you're going to find people who either aren't vegan or just the uninitiated, you'll get people telling you like, well, 80% of the people who go vegan, they don't stay vegan. And you hear that a lot. You've heard that before, right? I don't even.
They
say like all these people, you can't stick with it. It's impossible. And you get this kind of ex-vegan phenomenon, and there have been a lot of famous ones, like in our circle, like Cosmic Septic, and Alita Breezy. There's been a lot who are kind of famous vegans, and then all of a sudden they're not vegan anymore, and they do a little video. It's kind of like this whole ritual now. They become vegan, they get famous for being vegan, and then they do a video that is widely watched by vegans about why these people are no longer vegan. And sometimes like Sophia Esperanza, there's been all sorts. I can name a bunch off the top of my head. I think that anyone listening who's vegan right now can probably do the same. And it's annoying because you're like, well, why are there so many non-vegans? And I really have been thinking a lot about that. Why are there so many non-vegans? And I think I've kind of put it down to three reasons or three questions, I guess, that I want to kind of pose to you to see what you think about it. Okay. So if when you're vegan, did you have a person that turned you vegan?
No, not one person. No.
Yeah. I think that when you do and you have a person that turns you vegan, you end up more likely to go ex-vegan because you're kind of piggybacking off of somebody else's ethos. You're somebody convinced you. And if that person falls or has somehow is degraded by some other flaw in their personality or something else, you're like, oh, well, I guess everything's done and I'm not going to be vegan anymore because they failed in that regard. You need to kind of get there on your own. You can't be turned vegan.
Or like, I feel like people's consumer habits are really influenced by their friends and people around them. If they're that type of person. So if all of your friends and people around you aren't consuming a animal-free diet, then it's going to be very difficult for you too. But I personally am a loner. So that doesn't really make any difference to me because I don't hang around people and I don't have
any friends. Habits are, so. I get what you mean. Like habits are contagious, right? So if we're around people that overeat, we tend to overeat. If we get people that are gym rats, we tend to work out more. Like it's just that's a well-documented thing. I totally get what you mean. And if you're a loner, maybe it's a little easier to make your own decisions. But we're always influenced, right? And I feel like what happens is if you are so there's been a few that they get into this debate bro stuff and it's like total toxic masculinity. And you and I have talked about this a lot, but the dude bro world where it's like, I own that other guy and I told him to go vegan and he got owned because my logical ninja skills, I'm a Jedi with my logic and debate skills. And that's why that person went vegan. And okay, you owned that guy and now they went vegan. But what does that even mean? Like, and I think that when they're alone, when they are alone, you become your worst enemy and you start coming up. Now you're debating yourself. Now you're asking yourself, like Ali Tabrizi, the famous one, the last one, he says he went vegan and then he just decided, he argued with himself that driving this distance to find vegan marshmallows, this was the case for him, was more detrimental in this utilitarian framework that he'd built for himself, is more detrimental than just buying pig gelatin-based marshmallows. And it wasn't a principle thing to him. It was a utilitarian math problem. And when you're just stuck in this cycle in your brain, a toxic one, I think, you're going to end up becoming, you're going to out-debate yourself. You're going to debate yourself.
Yeah, that's the thing about people who are really good debaters.
Yeah.
End up being really horrible people because there's nobody who can challenge them. And you see this with like cult leaders who convince themselves that like doing horrible things to people is fine because they've like been able to debate anybody who said like, hey, actually what you're doing is bad. And then they can make all these arguments like, oh, I can treat women this way. I can manipulate women. I can romantically pursue all of these women. Oh, and the fact that you're saying that I can't, you're infantilizing women. Like they come up with all of these arguments.
And they're all utilitarian arguments too, I would say. And that's the other problem. They're not living. I think the goal of your human self should be the goal of being human should be cobbling together your own personal philosophy so that we can navigate a complex world and not just like I'm utilitarian and that's it and that's all I'm going to do. That's I'm going to see the world through one lens in all cases. That to me is
Nazis
like
Nazis were utilitarians.
That's what they did. Basically, that's a more complicated thing, but yes, I think they were basically a perversion of the of Jeremy Bentham utilitarianism. But that's a whole I only have 5 more minutes to make my point and I don't want to go down the Nazi rabbit hole. By the way, you put a dollar in the Nazi jar because I didn't bring him up.
Okay.
Okay, so the second one, I think this is easy. We could quickly we can quickly agree is that the sickness of the vegan community, because we are so about this argumentative and debate bro kind of culture and this utilitarian framework, you end up having people who we end up falling into this trap of the narcissism of small differences, right? I'm a better vegan than you. I have more vegan t-shirts. I go to more protests than you. I'm louder when I'm at those protests than you, and therefore I'm a better vegan than you. And it's not just infighting. It becomes this new system of oppression, this new hierarchy where one shouldn't exist. What do you think? Did I say that okay? Do you agree?
I get what you're saying. I just, it's almost like the people who become vegans are the ones willing to shirk social norms and what everybody else is doing around them. So any sort of new marginalized group of people movement who are actually doing good things, it has a tendency to attract a lot of narcissists, people willing to go against everybody else.
Well, I think it turns them into narcissists, though, because we're focusing on this small differences.
We're focusing on this one area and we're saying, I am better than everybody else because I now consume this diet, which is not true.
And the problem
because
it
comes from the idea that the animals are suffering more than anybody else. And so therefore nothing else matters except for what's happening to the animals. And there are more animals suffering than humans. So therefore, you know, we can't care about human rights. We should only care about animal rights. My issue matters more than any other issue. Veganism matters more than anything else. So there you go.
Okay, so here's my thesis then, because I think that this all comes down. I've only got like 90 seconds left.
Okay.
So the biggest problem with this is that we're seeing veganism as a diet. And I think just like you just said, like we've talked about this before. I don't think veganism is a diet, but that's, I think, a hill that I'll die on, and no one will care because no one agrees with me anymore. It used to be veganism was a philosophy. It was an ethical framework. And when you're confronted with those ethics, we're able to make better decisions about individuals and about how we interact with those individuals. I am for total liberation, and therefore I'm vegan. It's not this whole, I don't eat animals because it helps the environment and somehow lowers the amount of antibiotic resistance that I might cause. You know, I'm not doing these things in this this mathematical framework. I'm trying to interact with the world without enslaving others, because I respect every individual. And anyone who's met a dog knows that they're an individual. They're unlike any other dog in some way, right? They're having their own unique experiences. They're their own dog. We know that every animal is an individual who's unique and is worthy of our moral consideration. And if I think of people like Ali Tabrizi or some of these other people who have become quote unquote ex-vegans had confronted those ethics earlier on, then maybe we could stop having this ex-vegan phenomenon happen. So I'm trying to get rid of this toxic debate bro culture and this toxic narcissism of small differences and start interacting with other individuals by noticing and acknowledging their sanctity and the sanctity of their lives.
Yeah. Well, I'm disgusted by animal-based protein production, so I will not eat those things. But we are reaching the end of the hour. But if you have missed any of the show, you can always hear it again at the archives at kpft.org. Please tune in again for Vegan World Radio next Monday night, 7 to 8 p.m. with Patrick and Ocean. And thank you, Blue, our sound engineer. And do keep listening for more progressive programming here on KPFT 90.1 FM Pacifica Radio in Houston, Texas.
Yeah, and I'm Skyjack Morgan on YouTube, by the way. That's just who I am. Bye, everyone. Thank you. See you in 2 weeks.
I'll see you in the afterglow. The postmortem's live on Vegan World Radio.
Hey there, join me, Tom Hartman, at KPFT's Soiree on August 9th. I'll give a talk about the state of the nation after music provided by Grant Peoples, the self-described tree hugger that watches NASCAR. There'll be a Q&A session and a book signing afterwards. Date and time are Saturday, August 9th, 7 to 9 p.m. Doors open at 6 p.m. Location is Emerson Unitarian Universalist Church at 1900 Bering Drive in Houston. Tickets are $40 at the door or at the event link on KPFT's Facebook page. Students pay $25 with a valid student ID at the door. If you're concerned about the direction the country's going, come join me, Grant, and a bunch of like-minded people on